Hey, hey, this is Ricky Herbst, Cinema Program Director of the State of the Art Browning Cinema in the lovely DeBartolo Performing Arts Center on the bucolic campus of the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, St. Joe County, Indiana. And I'm here today recording, as always, with Kevin Krismanich, our tech director, who has also been pulling together the technology on our screenings each Wednesday evening. A big thanks to him for all of his hard work, and similarly, a big thanks to you for listening to this talk. As we've discussed, these first 6 weeks are our walk through the six modes of documentary Bill Nichols created to separate and define the various approaches directors and studios have through history used to convey what we might call reality in film and now in other media as well. Now in week four, we are hitting a somewhat crucial pivot in those six modes. Not only is it a crucial pivot, but it is theoretically a bit of a challenging one. The process of laying out and defining the taxonomies to this point has generally been straightforward, or at least I hope it has felt roughly that way. With this next set of three, the differences are more nuanced, which is a nice way of saying murky, which is a nice way of saying confusing to many, myself included. But that's great, as it allows us to make sense of the categories together. A couple of notes on that. First, there are other ways people have tried to break down different subgenres of documentaries. Tony de Bromhead, for example, says we can look at documentary subgenres through storytelling methods, which I want to break out as I think it could assist in making sense of the next three categories we will tackle through Bill Nichols' spectrum. Her taxonomies include 1, Hollywood storytelling with a standard three-act structure with character presentation, conflict, and resolution. For example, Three Identical Strangers that just came out. 2, detective storytelling, wherein the filmmaker's process into the journalistic process becomes a component of the film, for example, Herman's House. 3, discursive storytelling, which is really tracking expository documentaries from Nichols, giving weight to logic and data in order to educate or explain, for example, Central Park 5. 4, episodic storytelling, which takes events that lack direct relationships and are pulled together by overarching themes or even a singular theme, for example, Flaherty's The Nook of the North. 5, poetic storytelling, which aligns pretty much exactly with Nichols' theory on the matter, so for example, Samsara. And lastly, 6, hybrid modes, which serves as a bit of a catch-all, and she breaks them into diary films, where a director reflects on past events, for example, The Ties That Bind by Sue Friedrich, or road movies, where the journey is similarly individualized, but rather than looking backward to reflection, moves linearly forward. For example, D.A. Pennebaker's Don't Look Now. I bring that up not to confuse you, which maybe it did and mea culpa there, but to reinforce that we are dealing with art and not science. The categorization systems in play for documentary films are both ex post facto and ad hoc, meaning the classifications created by theorists are going to be applied to the system top down. And whenever that's the case, there are multiple ways to define whatever you're looking to group, order, and define. The important thing, and I'll say that this is the important thing again because it is such an important thing, is that we begin to see the traits and qualities documentaries assume, just as other genres have taken in film worlds like musicals and slashers and westerns. If we notice the patterns, then we become much more adept at reading the arguments, both overt and more implicit, in documentaries. So, if these next 3 weeks start to feel mushy, that's okay. Our goal remains to extract the tropes so that we can not only identify what is happening on the nightly news or in the hottest documentary blockbuster or in that viral video someone forwards you, but also to think to ourselves, how could this story have been told through other means by making us aware of various storytelling modes. Back to Nichols. We have already seen expository films where data and information and narration from above, for example, the voice of your nightly newscaster explaining the scenes on your television, convey some form of reality. Poetic films, where the images collide and smash to actively not form logical argumentation, but often through the addition of music, bring forward truths that the audience more actively devises on their own. And, most recently, observational docs, where we have a fly on the wall, not disturbing the world and offering a recording of events without the addition of extra data or sound to give what it purports to be an accurate rendering of reality. This week, we shift. The remaining three documentary modes Nichols outlines brings the filmmakers much more intimately into the process. Think of the difference in Buena Vista Social Club between the concert footage, which was very observational, and when the musicians were inviting the filmmaker into their homes, speaking directly to them, explaining, for example, the St. Lazarus statue. That second portion, as seen with Ibrahim Ferrer discussing the statue, is what we're going to be unpacking this week. And it's called The Participatory Mode of Documentary by Nichols. So Nichols grounds participatory documentaries in the world of social sciences, in particular anthropology, but it holds really for any field where a researcher, which could include the likes of a filmmaker, is going into the field, which is to say outside of their laboratory or outside of their office or outside of their movie studio, in order to gather data or information or footage. When that's occurring, there is some form of a participant-observer bond being formed. And we'll upfront note and put a pin in the power dynamics of whenever a participant-observer bond is being formed. But we'll get to unpacking that more in our discussions as we break down the remaining three modes of documentary that are really built to address that relationship more directly through these next screenings and through the end of the course. Now, a major difference between social scientists and documentary filmmakers is that the former's guilds have generally, over the last 50 years, built up various forms of ethics for how to approach people or animals or whatever is being studied. Documentary film doesn't have that set of ethics or protocols so cleanly stated. But it's worth noting that about the time fields like psychology are running through how to review the rights of participants in studies or how they are treated through review boards, at that same time, documentary film starts to grapple with filmmaker interaction with participants, not through conferences or symposia so much, but through film criticism and filmmakers addressing it through their actual filmmaking process and resulting films. The films of the participatory mode note that, at a minimum, the observational fly-on-the-wall documentary doesn't cut it. Just as Wim Wenders proved to be too distracting while filming in the recording studio, or even in cases where it seems more organic, the presence of the filmmaker, largely hidden in expository, poetic, and observational documentaries, has such an impact on this resulting film, how people are portrayed, how people perform themselves, how stories are presented, and more. To remove the filmmaker's participation in the documentary loses an essence of its reality and, looking at some of the ethical arguments, removes how a filmmaker might have altered a situation through their presence. Put another way, participatory documentaries want to show us the world as it is being engaged by the filmmaker. When Wim Wenders or whomever is being addressed by Ibrahim Ferrer about the Lazarus statue, that is participatory. The articulation to the audience from the actor involves recognition that the filmmaker is present and addressed. It says, in some form, this footage relates to how the conversation was unfolding between the participant, Ibrahim, and the cinematographer. The participation between the filmmaker and the scene is not hidden, as it is in, say, the concert footage, or when we are seeing the sand dunes in Samsara. The filmmaker's placement in the documentary in that moment is acknowledged. Now, the degree to which the filmmaker's participation is acknowledged, the process by which it is acknowledged, and how it impacts the final form of the documentary is what is going to break out the last three modes of Nichols' classification system. With participatory documentaries, though, the real gist is that the interaction between the filmmaker and the world is part of the film's final cut, which is one reason interviews are crucial to the subgenre, just like anthropology or sociology or various other forms of social sciences that employ interviews. Now, you might be saying, dear Ricky Herbst, aren't interviews a hallmark of expository films? Sure, they certainly can be. Let's try and unpack the difference by using a couple of scenes in Buena Vista Social Club. Expository interviews, I would argue, shift the tenor of what is being said to a narration by delocalizing both the speaker and the filmmaker. As such, when musicians are giving history and it overlays images of Havana streets, of instruments playing, or when Ry Cooder is explaining the process by which he pulled together the band, those interviews are more narration, giving data points that are reinforced by image, with the process therein erasing the filmmaker who was present. That reads much more like an expository film mechanism. Conversely, when Ry and Ibrahim are sitting, not really facing each other, but more so looking in the direction of the camera and having a conversation through an interpreter, that shows the footprint of the filmmaker, the filmmaking process, how the camera was quote-unquote being there along with the event with a form, albeit very light, of acknowledgement that the filmmaker had some impact. Compare that scene to, say, the New York City footage, which reads much more observational, where the filmmaker is removing themselves from the scene in order to make the conversations by the musicians about the Statue of Liberty, for example, seem more uninterrupted, more organic. And given the prevalence of interviews in participatory documentaries, I think it is useful to re-highlight what Nichols says about them as a social encounter, if nothing else, to show the breadth of techniques that are at play, again, so that we might start to see the fractals among those techniques. Documentary interviews can be coercive, as one might expect from a suspect who is being questioned by authorities. Documentary interviews might take a more survey approach, asking for specific information from multiple people woven together in a film like a census broken strand by strand. Documentary interviews can take a clinical or counseling approach and appear more humanistic or therapeutic. Documentary interviews can be of the press conference variety, where people arrive with a contrived message to report to the interviewer. Documentary interviews can be Socratic and challenging, pushing for explanation or rebuffing what a participant might say. You can see how all of these techniques are going to shift the role of the interviewer, the role of the filmmaker, the type of participation the filmmaking process has in the world, the experience of the person being interviewed, the information gleaned from the interview, and ultimately what the end film presents. Before hopping into Grey Gardens, which has its own brand of participatory mode, I want to quickly highlight a film that Shirley Clarke made. Clarke is a towering figure in the world of cinema, particularly documentary and experimentary film, working from the 1950s until the 1980s. One of her films, Portrait of Jason from 1967, is hugely influential on participatory mode films and the acknowledgement of filmmakers in the formation of the documentary. Filmed over 12 hours on a Saturday night, Portrait of Jason is an interview Clarke performed with her partner Carl Lee. Together, they interviewed Jason Holliday, who tells various stories from his life, his street hustling, his various forms of performance. Under the influence as the night progresses, Jason, as an interview, becomes more and more questionable, although he appears always aware of his performance as someone being interviewed. In turn, Clark and Lee become more active in goading the performance from Jason, actively performing the interviewer role with a similar artifice to Jason and with actual frustration that also aligns with some of Jason's stories. The off-camera voices of Clark and Lee become more hostile, prompting a performance from Jason that lays pellucidly clear how much influence the filmmaker has in the interview process, how involved they are in creating an interview, and how, with Jason, how aware the participant is of their need to perform as a social actor. Do Clark and Lee exploit Jason? Does Jason exploit Clark and Lee? These questions come out in due part because of the participatory nature of the filmmakers in the final product, making it a film that opens questions of race and sexuality and class, even if untidily, and perhaps in a way many would judge to be unethical. As a point of seeing the early boundaries of participatory documentary, Portrait of Jason is an excellent film to check out. Grey Gardens employs a much lighter form of participation in the subject, but the involvement of the filmmaker is still present and able for us to consider. Albert and David Maisels, brothers behind influential films like Salesman and Gimme Shelter, both of the observational documentary style, are major players not only in documentary cinema, but cinema with a capital C in the 1960s and 70s, making films often about artists and their process. Working with two other editors who received directorial credit for their work, Ellen Hovde and Muffy Meyer, the Maisels brothers visited the dilapidated grounds of the Grey Gardens estate to interview Edith Ewing Bouvier-Beale, or Big Edie, and Edith Bouvier-Beale, or Little Edie, socialites in decay, who are the aunt and first cousin of Jackie Kennedy. Here, let me quickly quote the song A Lady of a Certain Age by the Divine Comedy. You chased the sun around the Côte d'Azur until the light of youth became obscured and left you on your own and in the shade, an English lady of a certain age. And if a nice young man would buy you a drink, you'd say with a conspiratorial wink, you wouldn't think that I was 70, and he'd say, no, you couldn't be. That, in a nutshell, is the Beals. Reclusive, yet performative, the Maisels found participants who gladly wanted to re-inhabit yesteryear, and the Maisels made that a possibility, all while the film is acutely aware of and captures the ramshackle world that those memories resound and rebound within. Germane to our subgenre, the Maisels brothers don't hide their presence. While not actively involved in the performance generation or interview like Clark and Lee in Portrait of Jason, and again, note the sliding scale of the degree to which directors insert themselves in documentaries and how they do so, the Maisels do ensure their participation in the documentation of Grey Gardens and in the performances of both Big and Little Edie goes noticed. Interviews run through the camera. Unlike an observational documentary where it's a security camera coldness, Big and Little Edie speak directly to their interviewers, their documenters, their filmmakers, the cameras. There is an acknowledgement by both parties of everyone's participation in the creation of the film. And that's big. That's really big. Think how often that goes unspoken or unacknowledged, yet is crucial to any recreation or transfer of information or items or whatnot. From farm-to-table restaurants to museums that acknowledge how artifacts were plundered, to apparel companies that outline the process of creation. Think how often we leave unchecked or purposely conceal how something came to be before us. Now, simultaneously ask yourself if a person could ever give an accurate accounting of how their participation in how a film or whatever project came to be, and you have the scene set for the next two modes of documentary. But Grey Gardens has a huge cultural footprint. If documentaries are the redheaded stepchild to narrative films, I think Grey Gardens is the Annie of that lot. plucked from the genre to head to Daddy Warbucks' house. And why is that? There's a lightning in the bottle quality to the film, hitting about the decay of a nation with stars with connections to Kennedy Camelot as Nixon has just come and gone. That spoke loudly to the nation. There's the freak show element, and I use that term with as little venom as possible, but the Beals are curiosities in a curio cabinet that is the Grey Gardens Estates that is fascinating to see in its unraveling. People love watching their willingness to turn on that socialite charm and perform the way a sector of American blue blood Northeastern upper crust was taught to do, especially along very gendered lines. There's also a very compelling mother-daughter relationship, getting to interviews as therapy that unpacks itself on screen and, in turn, allows for the audience to have shared identification and reflect on relationships with caregivers or those who give us care. Is that identification a good thing? Not everyone would say so, but it undoubtedly pushes the identification the audience is able to have with the film's subjects and participants. Leaving open the film's qualities that make it persuasive and to what it is trying to persuade to, I'd like to note exactly the size and extent of Grey Gardens' impact. The documentary inspired a musical adaptation in 2006. It was the first documentary to be adapted into a musical, from what I gather. The show won both Christine Ebersole and Mary Louise Wilson Tonys for their performances of Big Edie and Little Edie. Think about that. Musical theater, a world where personalities are about as large as they come on stage, was able to support the story of two people interviewed in who perform in a documentary. That should speak to participants' abilities in documentaries to perform themselves at heightened levels. Of another note, HBO made a film about the Beals with Jessica Lange as Big Edie and Drew Barrymore as Little Edie that itself hauled in Emmys and Golden Globes. Rufus Wainwright has a song, Grey Gardens. Note here the cult status the film has within the queer, particularly gay male community. And Little Edie's stylings have been recreated in shoots and runways for years. Lastly, it was the subject of one of the Documentary Now parodies, with Bill Hader assuming the role of Little Edie and Fred Armisen as Big Edie. Quick note there that Documentary Now on Netflix is an excellent mechanism for seeing tropes documentaries use exposed in a particularly useful way, I think, even if you haven't seen the source material previously. That's worth checking out. But with Grey Gardens, a lingering question, I think, is how did the participation of the Maisels in the filming, their eschewing of this film being observational like some of their previous work, coax out performances that would move people to remake those performances in various genres and styles? What about the filmmaker as active interviewer elicits particular performances? How does the camera as an object through which performance can be routed, serve as catalyst for social acting, for performing ourselves, for performing the people we think an audience might expect us to be? Those are crucial questions whenever we engage a text where people are playing themselves and can be our guiding map as we go on our open house of Grey Gardens this week. Again, thanks Kevin Krasmanich for the sound engineering, Stacey Stikovich for the online engineering, and thank you all for listening.